Hi there, I'm Chris Bowers and welcome to the Tennis Worthy podcast. In a week in which we've lost another member of the tennis family, Fred Stolle, the Australian great from the 1960s, who was inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 1985, has died at the age of 86. The Hall of Fame is able to pay tribute to Fiery Fred through this interview I did with him at Roland Garros in 2018. It was the last year Fred commentated from Paris, as illness started to blight the final years of his life. But I caught him in the corner of the media cafe and seized the opportunity to get him to talk about his life in tennis. A few doors banged in the background and there was even a tennis match being played, but Fred was never happier than when he was watching tennis at a great venue. I began by asking him how he first got the tennis bug.
Well, Mum and Dad played, and they grew up playing on the same team, actually, when they were dating one another. And obviously, after they got married and got into it, they played. And I got my first racket when I was about eight off a friend of my dad's. And I used to hang around at the weekend and ball boy and hit some balls between sets, and that's how we sort of started. But I came from a family that didn't have a lot of money, and it was difficult in those days. My first trip overseas was by public subscription, and Harry Hopman helped there, but it took my dad and a friend of his 9 months to raise $3,000 so that I could come on my first trip. And the deal we had was to try and qualify for all the Grand Slams.
At the time, we had the split amateur and professional circuits. You got the great Australians, Rosewall, Hode, Sedgman. They'd all turned professional. What was the Australian tennis culture like at that time?
As a kid, you know, I'd listened on the radio, and there was no television in those days. I can still remember Ken McGregor losing in the final to Dick Savitt, and I saw it in the headlines. Of, you know, you dream of actually trying to get over here. And by the time we left Paris, we had £20 in our pocket to go to London and try and qualify for Wimbledon. Well, we got an invitation to go back to Italy for a little bit of expense money, and so that saved us, and that kept us on track for the rest of the year. But then you go back, and I was a banker. I was told I wasn't good enough to go and work for Dunlop's, one of the sporting goods companies, as kids did then, and you went and you either learnt to string rackets, but you got time off to practice. Well, I finished up working in a bank, which eventually worked out pretty well for me, because when I came overseas, I knew the conversion rates of all the currencies. But it was tough going, and you just had to, you know, you've got to get out there and work. So I'd like to hear these stories today with the players that really have come from not a lot, and just through perseverance and hard work and desire, believe in themselves.
You mentioned Harry Hopman there. I mean, he's a legend in Australian tennis, but he could also be a bit of a tyrant, couldn't he?
Almost definitely. I could tell you a lot of Harry Hopman stories. He didn't particularly like me. And when I finally got picked in an Australian team, Bob Hewitt got kicked off the team for hitting a ball out of the stadium in Melbourne, and not out of the stadium, just out of one of the courts. And he was dropped off the team, so I was the fourth man. And in those days, if you're named in the four members of the squad, you couldn't play for another country. So as it turned out, it was a blessing in disguise for Bob Hewitt. And Bob and I were the best doubles team in the world for two or three years, as we won a couple of Wimbledon titles. But I went in as the fourth man, and we played Italy in the challenge round. And I was introduced in front of about 200 people at the town hall in Melbourne by Mr. Hopman as the fourth member of the team, but somebody that was never going to be good enough to represent Australia. We had Laver and we had Fraser and Emerson on the team, and I was the fourth man.
Did Hopman actually say in public that you're the guy that would never make it?
He actually said in public, and that made me feel real good, as you can imagine, with family and everybody there. So I had to persevere with that. But if you didn't behave yourself with Mr. Hopman, you would not play Davis Cup. And it wasn't the fact that I misbehaved, but he didn't feel that I was working hard enough. I didn't like to run. I could spend 6 hours on the practice court any day of the week. Of course, part of his regiment was, after you finished, you used to have to go for a 2-mile run. Well, I wasn't a bad runner, but I didn't like running those 2 miles at the end of the day. But he was a tough master.
And yet he stood by you in that big diplomatic spat when you were actually suspended for a short time for playing overseas for longer than the Lawn Tennis Association of Australia wanted you to. And he eventually actually stuck by you and let Hewitt and Mulligan go abroad.
Yes, well, I was working with Rothmans, a cigarette company. And the other boys went on what they called private tours in those days, and that meant you got expenses to play and so forth. And in those days, you weren't allowed to leave Australia before the end of February after you'd done and played exhibitions in the country areas. They controlled the players if you wanted to play for Australia, which we all did. And I was working and I was the last holdout. And I went to Monte Carlo and I decided that I was going to join the guys and play before our date was up. And they went to the lengths of going to my employer and all that. But my employer stuck by me and said, Fred, whatever you want to do, we will back you in what you want to do. So I elected to play. And so we were banned. And then the Davis Cup draw came out. And they had a look at the draw and they said, well, boy, we got a pretty good draw here. But we only have the juniors in those days. And they were 6 years younger than Roy and myself. We had Newcomb and Roach and Owen Davidson, Bill Bowery. And so they basically wanted Roy back, not so much me, because I still wasn't in Hop's good books. But at that stage, I was in two Wimbledon final and still hadn't played Davis Cup for Australia. And so they made a deal with Roy and I to come back. It was interesting because the year before when Newcomb played, he told me that I was too stale and to go and take my wife to the beach. So I wasn't going to play. The next year in 64, we're in Mexico, and I played against John Newcomb in a practice match at Chapultepec on a back court, a rough court, and obviously Roy was going to play, and so Hop sent Nuke and I down there to play, and Nuke won the first set, and I walked up, Mr. Hopman, and I said, Mr. Hopman, if you think this is the way I want to represent my country, then, the proverbial, he sent me back to the hotel. So there was no way in my mind that I was going to play.
So he didn't respect the fact that you stood up against him?
Well, I think he must have eventually, but he sent me out to dinner that night with the boys. I was staying in the hotel with Hopman, Emerson, Stolle in one room, and we had Newcomb, Roach and Davidson in another. So he sent me out to dinner with the boys, which was fine. We ate together all the time. And he went out to dinner with Roy. So Roy must have said something to Hop, and so the next day we went over to the draw and we walked over and he actually told John Newcomb that he wasn't going to play, but he didn't say one word to me. And so I was obviously under the impression that I wasn't going to play. So when my name came out, we sit down. And you know how you do at the Davis Cup draw. You sit down, somebody pulls your name out of the Davis Cup and that's it. My name comes out. I went the colour of that white shirt you got on. And I had to play Rafael Osuna. I lost that match in straight sets, and then Roy won, and then Roy and I were doubles teams at that stage, and we beat Palafox no sooner, which was at that stage the longest Davis Cup match. It went for about 4.5 hours, and we won 10-8 in the fifth. We were down a couple of match points, but I never dropped serve in the five sets, and so Mr. Hopman realised that my nerves would carry me through matches like that. So then the next day, I played some good tennis and I beat Palafox easily the next day and we went on to beat Mexico. And then long story, there's another story, a few stories, Hopman stories that goes through to the end of that season because we then played, I think it was Chile and then we played Sweden and then we played the US in Cleveland on clay.
Do you call him Mr. Hopman till his dying day?
Yes, well, actually, it was funny how things worked out. By the end of his life, I knew exactly the way he thought, and he knew exactly the way I thought, and we were very dear friends, and I had the privilege of doing the eulogy at his funeral.
Your first five Grand Slam finals, you lost them all, but the fifth one must have been the worst of all because you led Emerson by 2 sets to love, and he still beat you.
Yeah, well, I led 2 sets to 1 and 2 service breaks in the fourth. But I was a gagger. I served, I didn't have much margin on my second serve, and I got nervous. And I beat Roy in a few matches, but not none of the big ones. I didn't realise up until a couple of years ago that I played in 8 Grand Slam singles finals, but I played in 5 in a row. And I don't think that's been done too many times, even 5 in a row. Even this day, they win. But the boys are that good now, they share them around a bit. Well, in those days, between 63 and 68, when the top players couldn't play, Roy and I were the top players for a couple of years. So we played against one another pretty much Grand Slam finals in 64, 65, 66. And Roy beat me in five of those Grand Slam finals, five of the eight that I was in.
So it must have been immensely satisfying when you finally won your first major title at the French 65.
Well, it certainly was. It was the first one here, and I won the doubles that year with Roy, but that was my first Grand Slam. And in those days, I think I got 600 French francs. I don't know how much that was, but not a lot. So what did I do? It was my first title, so I went straight out of here, and I booked a table at the Lido. And I took four Australian boys to the Lido, and we watched the show, and there went my 600 francs.
Pre-professional days. What about the US Championship, the one that you won 66?
Well, that was one that Coombe Bell I'd lost in the final in 64. 66 I went through and played John Newcomb, had a long second set with Nuke, and Nuke doesn't really remember too many of the ones he lost. He hit a lob over my head and I went back and I couldn't see too much, and I finished up hitting a cross-court backhand that went for a winner, and Nuke was expecting a lob to go up and I was expecting to lose the point, but somehow the backhand went in and I got out and won that set and won the next two. So that was a pretty nice win for me at that stage, and we'd won a couple of Davis Cup years in that, and then that was Mr. Hopman again. You know, he was against professional tennis, but he switched around somewhat towards the end of his career, and he said, if you can get a decent contract, he said, you know, you might be there for another year with the boys breathing down your neck, the boys being Newcomb and Roach, and MO was still there, and I turned pro in 66, and then Roy followed me the year after.
And then 18 months after you turned pro, the whole of tennis turned pro, and your latter years were actually sort of on the reunited tennis circuit.
Yeah, it was fantastic, actually, because I didn't miss playing at Wimbledon, pretty much, because we went from that year, we played the first pro match at Wimbledon. I played the first pro match there, and we played eight pros, and I played Rod in the first match on centre court, and it was played in August after the championships, and I lost to Rocket, and then the next match was Hoad versus Gonzalez. And Lou was my idol, and obviously he'd been down in Spain. He came into town with his clay court sneakers on and everything, but he and Gonzalez had a great rivalry over the years, and it was something I wanted to see. So I raced up and got in the, you know, where the players area is up there, and they got to match point for Lou in the third. And Lou threw up a lob over Pancho's head going away from the royal box end up to the other end. And Gonzalez looked at it and thought it was going out. Didn't chase it. Took up the chalk. Game, set, and match to Hoad. And Hoad, he put his hands up and he knew we were all up in the stands. And that was the start of everything with open tennis. And then it came about and now it's grown into what it is today, which is magnificent.
Most of your post-playing career has been spent doing TV, but you also had a few years coaching Vitas Karolaitis. That must have been quite an interesting experience.
Yes, very interesting, Chris. And 4 years and four of the best years. Because Vitas had a habit, he was very superstitious. And when we travelled over here, he'd say, okay, coach, go and get the Michelin guide and pick out the restaurants that are there with the three stars or whatever many stars and just book a table. And so, and whatever restaurant he went to, if he was winning, he liked to stay at that restaurant, go back to that restaurant. And boy, we ate in some fine restaurants for a couple of years. But one story I'll tell you is that the Tour d'Argent, with a very famous duck restaurant here in Paris, we were up there, and obviously I enjoy a beer and I had a glass of wine, and Vitas never drank. He used to drink Coca-Cola. Tour d'Argent does not sell Coca-Cola. Or didn't then. So here we are, one of the most expensive restaurants in Paris, and no Coca-Cola. He drank them out of every drop of orange juice that they had.
Finally, Fred, what do you think is your greatest achievement in tennis?
Well, I like to think that I'm a straight shooter and I'm not politically correct, and I've always been a little bit proud of that fact, because I think some of the things that are done in today's world of tennis and over the years have been very political, and I think they still are. And I speak my mind about it, and I feel that I've given my best to the game, and it was something that I'm very proud of, that I was able to be successful enough to have a happy life and a happy wife, and that's the main thing. Married 57 years and great kids, and it's all because of tennis. Otherwise, I could have been a bank clerk somewhere in Australia.
Well, the banking world's loss was tennis's gain. The inimitable Fred Stolle, who's died at the age of 86. And our thoughts go to his wife, Pat, and their three children, Monique, Nadine and Sandon, the 22-time ATP Tour doubles titlist who, like his dad, was an Australian Davis Cup player. Fred Stolle, a member of a truly great Australian tennis generation.